The Diary, a short story in a collection of short stories titled The Leaving by Budge Wilson. The Diary, January 1st. Here it is, then. You said on Friday that if I found it impossible to talk about it, I should try to write it all down. You suggested that it was a good way to start the new year, like a resolution, something new and changing. You told me not to worry about grammar or sentence structure, but just to let it all pour out like a boil releasing its poisons. Its pus, in fact, your word, not mine. This is not easy for me, releasing anything, that is, or to tell you the truth, to write anything without checking to make sure it is correct, without erasing any mistakes or signs of carelessness. My father said that anything worth doing was worth doing well. Nonetheless, I will try. Fortunately, you also said that I don't have to show the diary to you. I don't expect that I will. I can't bear the kind of disloyalty that washes family linen, soiled or otherwise, in public, and to strangers. Although, of course, you are not really a stranger, but you know what I mean. And I'm here alone. No one can see what I'm saying or how I'm saying it. But that's the crazy part. Even when I'm alone, maybe especially when I'm alone, I sit in judgment upon myself. I am my own judge and jailer. Probably that's hackneyed, and maybe even a quote. But I'm going to try not to worry about that sort of thing. This is a diary, not a piece of literature. I am 55 years old. I am married to a businessman who is successful and scrupulously honest. His name is Meredith Wentworth. I feel that the name has weight and dignity. He usually treats me with respect and decency. We have two sons, both of them in their 20s. Their names are Gerald and Luther. They have always been well-behaved and courteous, and they are now employed in their father's business. I have no daughters. Some people say that that is unfortunate, but I don't mind at all because you never really miss something that you never had. Tonight the boys are coming to dinner with their girlfriends. I must put the turkey in the oven before too long. Gerald's girl wears too much makeup. Her clothes are invariably too tight, and her name is Samantha. Can you believe such a name? I've often seen them together downtown, but this is the first time he has brought her home. When they are together, they touch one another far too much. This worries me. Meredith is almost certain to disapprove. She is not Luther's type either. His girl's name is Jane, and she is everything a parent could hope for in a daughter-in-law. I'm hoping against hope that they will marry. January 3rd. I didn't write yesterday because I was too tired. You said I was not to force it, although you also advised me to write something every day, even if it was just how I felt. I feel terrible. That's mainly because of New Year's dinner. But that's not primarily what you wanted me to write about. You said to try to write about my childhood. All right, the least I can do, I suppose, is to make an effort. When I think back to my childhood, the first image I see is my father. He was enormous, or at least he seemed. In snapshots, he appears to be about the same height as other men. But even with the visual evidence before me, I find this hard to believe. He was very dark, with a black beard, in the days before anyone had a beard, except possibly one's grandfather. He wore thick glasses, and his eyes were very fixed and piercing behind them. He was a Presbyterian minister. I can see him up there, huge and erect in his black robes, lifted far above us by his pulpit and by his purpose. His voice was deep and powerful and very compelling. The wages of sin is death, he would boom down at us from on high. With his voice, his bearing, it was easy to believe him. Then the hymns would follow, militantly urging virtue or melodiously promising peace and joy to the sinless. I believed everything he said. It's not hard to do this. After all, he was my father. Besides, he looked exactly like God. New Year's dinner was just dreadful. Samantha's neckline was so low that you could see the division between her breasts. Meredith was very controlled and as polite to her as to Jane, who wore a beige cashmere dress. Very suitable. But I could see him looking at Samantha's dangling earrings, her untidy mass of curly hair, her chest, and her eyes like stones. Gerald looked cross and uncomfortable, although I think they were doing something with their feet under the table. Jane was perfect, of course, and tried to draw Samantha into the conversation. But none of her topics seemed to be in areas that interest Samantha. She mentioned junior league activities, a recent trip to Europe, inflation, the Princess of Wales children, a whole spectrum of subjects, but Samantha had almost nothing to say. She is quite pretty, or would be if she would comb her hair and do something about her clothes. I can't for the life of me understand why Gerald doesn't make her change. He calls her Sam, and when he looks at her, I will admit to you now, on paper, something I could never tell you face to face. I am jealous. No man has ever looked at me that way, as though he were seeing a vision, something delectable, desirable, but sparkled with grace. But it is the tenderness that really eats into my heart and fills me with an envy as green as grass. I said that no one had ever looked at me that way, but that's not strictly true. There was Jamie. I thought about Jamie as I watched them. Then I tried to concentrate on the turkey, on the preparation and serving of food. I couldn't cope with all the conflicting things I was feeling or with the vibrations shooting back and forth across the table. January 4th. I wrote a lot yesterday, so I needn't write as much today. My father was a strong parent in our house. My mother was small and mousy. I can't remember her with anything but gray hair. She wore house dresses out of Eaton's catalog and no makeup. She did everything my father asked or told her to. And she never argued. I don't ever remember a fight in our house. I was an only child. My father talked a lot. He told us about how to behave. He was even more eager to discuss sin. He described the wicked people in the congregation and in the town and the evil things they did. It never occurred to me to like those people, or rarely. Once I started a friendship with a girl called Gertie Bowen and invited her home one day to play. She was a lot of fun, and I loved her laugh, which was sort of a joyful shriek. My father took me aside afterward and told me that her father drank too much and that her mother was a bad woman, and that it would be a poor example for a minister's daughter to spend much time with people like that. I could see his point. He also talked a great deal about lying and stealing and coveting and cheating and vanity. One day my mother came home in a cornflower blue dress. She looked pretty, which was unusual for her, and she seemed cheerful and happy. I was so proud of her and hugged her and told her how lovely she looked. My father stood up and said, "Where did you get the money?" And she said, "From Aunt Julia for Christmas." Then he said, "I find that color vulgar. And besides, we could use the money. Even I can tell that dress was not cheap. We are not royalty. We have no need for such finery." She said, "Yes, Arthur," and left the room. She looked small and tired, even from the back. We never saw the dress again. I've written more than I intended. January 5th. I wanted so badly to get to heaven when I was small. I still do. It sounded like such a peaceful, shining place. I was scared of God, but I was assured by my father that if I did exactly what he told me to do, he would be kind and loving forever. This meant that I must never, never lie or steal or cheat or even think bad thoughts. It was particularly hard not to think bad thoughts, but every time one nudged itself into my head, I would order it out, clench my fists, and try to think of beautiful things. I became very skillful at this, but it took enormous effort. I always kept hoping that if I did everything right, my father, like God, would also be soft and loving. Sometimes he said, "Good for you, Allison," when I did something unusually wonderful, like the time I gave away my new doll to a poor girl on Water Street who had received no Christmas presents. It wasn't my idea, which I suppose would have been better, but at least I did it. But even then, he didn't hug me or anything, or say, "I love you," or stroke my hair the way I'd seen other fathers do. Dolls' heads were made of china then, with soft cloth bodies. She had blue eyes, like real eyes, with eyelashes, and they opened and closed when you changed the position of her head. She had a mauve dress with ruffles on the skirt, and a head full of tiny black curls, real hair. Not just painted on. January 6th. I'm too tired to write today. Gerald came to see his father this morning, and they were in Meredith's study for 25 minutes. Although I couldn't hear what they were saying, I didn't like the sound of their voices. When they came out, Meredith was looking pale and frozen, but saying nothing. Gerald turned to his father and said, "I am 26, Dad," with a look on his face that I can't even describe. Then he dashed out of the house, slamming the door, without even looking at me. Meredith stood perfectly still in the front hall and then went back into his study, closing the door with exaggerated care. I wish I didn't have this awful desire to cry all the time. January 7th. When I saw you today, you said that I must try to write about the past, even if my mind is preoccupied with the present. It's all right, you said, to mention what's going on, but that I might find everything, including the present, easier to cope with if I dug up all the really old stuff. I forgot to mention that the day I gave away my doll, my mother cried. I can't remember if I did. I can't remember anything else at all about that day. January 8th. I will never, never forgive you if I ever catch you lying. That is exactly what my father said to me that day in June. I can hear him still as clearly as if it were yesterday. He had seen a neighboring boy, Joe Hamany was his name, steal one of our daffodils the day before. The next day when Joe appeared on the sidewalk, Father rushed out to scold him, to punish him. His face was red with anger and his eyes were like black bullets. "How dare you pick one of our flowers," he shouted, waving his fist. "How dare you steal my property?" The little boy was white with fright. I didn't, he whispered. "Someone else did it. I didn't." And then he ran away. "Liar, liar," yelled my father. "Worse by far than a thief." And then he told me what he would do to me if he ever caught me lying. Gerald wants to marry Samantha. We are all in a state of shock. Jane and Luther won't even discuss it with him. And Meredith, of course, is beside himself. I don't know what to do. Worse still, I don't even know what to think. January 9th. This is a bad part and will be hard for me to tell. But I don't have to show it to you if I don't want to. You told me that. One day, when I was 8 years old, Father was in a terrible mood. It was Saturday, which meant that he was writing his sermon, and he was always nervous on those days. I was playing hopscotch on the pattern of the parlor rug when suddenly I tripped and fell against a table. The table swayed and then righted itself, but not before a glass lamp fell over onto the floor and broke in 1,000 pieces. My father heard the crash and came rushing in, pen in one hand, a sheet of paper in the other. He saw the lamp immediately and fixed me with his terrible look. "Who did that?" he roared. "Did you break the lamp?" "No." The answer was out before I had time to think. The dog rushed in just now and caught the cord, and over it went. Jason! It was Jason! My fear had been terrible, but what I was feeling now was 100 times worse. I stood on the carpet, as though turned to stone, listening while he shouted for Jason. Then I held my hands over my ears while he beat the dog, hearing his squeals through my palms. I went into my room and crawled into bed, making myself as small as possible. I cannot describe the weight of my guilt. When Jason crept into the room, tail between his legs, I picked him up and held him with a shame and a remorse that was boundless, patting him, stroking him, and whispering, "I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Forgive me, Jason." I knew I must confess, and yet I also knew I must not confess, all at the same time, for if I did tell him, my father would never forgive me that lie. If I did not, I felt that the warm face of heaven would be hidden from me for all time, that God would forever turn his back upon me. I didn't cry. Sorrow was not what I was feeling. I felt a numbing fear and a regret so deep that I was drowning in it. Lost grace. That's what I felt. Grace irrevocably removed from me. I feel so ashamed of the things I have told you about my father. I have made him sound like an ogre in a fairy tale. He wasn't. He gave away a fifth of his small salary to the church. He allowed himself no luxuries. He visited the sick and the dying. And his sermons were thrilling, inspiring. Ladies in the congregation sometimes cried while he was speaking. He wanted everyone in the world to be good. You maybe can't believe it, But I was worried about the lamp, that lie, for 4 years. I rehearsed speeches that I never delivered. I prayed for forgiveness, but felt there could be no forgiveness without confession. I would watch other children playing, strangers walking briskly along the street, animals running in the field, and think, oh, to be one of them without this binding burden on my heart. I went about my day, everyday living, going to school, playing ball, drying the dishes, but always in this small part of my heart or head was this hard core of guilt, this feeling that I was doomed unless or until I told my father what had really happened to that lamp. Samantha came and talked to me today. I like her. She lacks refinement, but she is warm and quick and passionate, which is more than you can say for either Luther or his father, both cold fish and very virtuous and upright and controlled. It is a terrible and unnatural thing to say about one's own son, but I do not altogether like Luther. I love him, of course. That is a different thing entirely, but his heart is squeezed and arrogant, and I often do not like him at all. Gerald is the spontaneous one and kind. As for me, I don't know what I am. But I can tell you one thing. I can feel in the air. Samantha likes me. January 11th. I know I'll never be able to show you this book. I reread yesterday's entry and I was shocked to see I had called my own son and husband cold fish. I broke the lamp when I was 8. One day when I was 12, my father and I were looking through an old family album in the parlor. Wait, he said, it's getting dark. I'll get a lamp. He brought a lamp from his study and placed it on the same table that had held the first ill-fated lamp. I heard myself speaking as though it were someone else, as though a piece of quite casual information were being offered. I had rehearsed the words so often that when they finally came out, they emerged without tone or emphasis. They might have been the tapping of typewriter keys. Father, I heard the voice say, remember the old glass lamp, the one that used to be on this table? Oh, yes, I guess so. Well, it was me that broke it. I don't know what I expected. Probably a spectacular display of rage or an icy comment upon my sin, followed by a promise of eternal damnation. I think I had also half hoped for a thunder of drums or the sweet swell of violin strings to accompany the end of my long period of fear and guilt. But not much of anything happened. Oh, he said, did you? But I could see that he had long ago forgotten the episode, or possibly he was too preoccupied by what he was looking at to pay much attention. Not that it mattered that much. Not really. It is true that I was relieved, but I also knew in that moment, without the smallest doubt, that crime never pays. If retribution does not come from without, it will surely always come from within. Look at what I had suffered during the past 4 years. I would watch my step even more carefully in the future. January 12th. I can see by looking at old photographs that as a teenager I was pretty. I was also shapely. I can remember Mother's sly remarks to me about my clothes. Your father wants you to stop wearing that red dress, dear. He says it makes your bust too obvious. He says that modesty is a woman's most attractive feature. I think now she said this a bit wistfully, being flat as a board herself. I would have felt better if he had called breasts, breasts. Bust is a terrible word. It smacks of corseted spinsters or of plaster of Paris. When I wore the clothes I liked, I felt cheap and vulgar. When I wore the kind of things he wanted me to wear, I felt droopy, desexed, undesirable. Either way, I was a loser. But Jamie desired me. Blousy tops, loose waists and all, he still looked at me as though I were a mixture of Lana Turner, a chocolate milkshake, and a delicate flower. January 13th. I am going to write about Jamie now. Jamie worked at Sullivan's Garage after school, so he didn't have much time for parties or dating. But during the spring when I was 16, he spent every one of his spare moments stationed in the vacant lot across the road from our house or walking up and down the street, kicking stones in front of him as he went. If I came out the front door, his face would burst wide open with joy, and he would come forward to accompany me wherever I was going. When Father found out that his mother had once been charged with petty theft, He told me that I must never bring him into the house, and that I must never, under any circumstance, accept any invitations from him. But even Father could not refuse him access to the vacant lot or to the municipal sidewalk, or so I thought. One day, quite by accident, I saw Jamie downtown. We met eye to eye over the mittens and gloves section of Woolworths. Face aflame, he reached over and touched one of my cheeks, and then kissed me, most tenderly, on the other. Such an innocent and lovely thing. It was my first kiss of any kind, and I came very close indeed to falling headfirst into the mittens. But Father saw us. He was standing not 10 feet away in the hardware department. When I returned home, Father explained to me where such behavior might lead. To the devil, to hell, to social disgrace, but more important, to the East Concook Home for Unmarried Mothers. One day when I returned home from an errand downtown, I saw Father talking to Jamie at the end of our walk. They were both gone by the time I reached the house, so I never knew what had taken place between them. But Jamie never returned. The vacant lot remained vacant, and the sidewalk bare. I thought I would die. But I did not. January 14th. I have just reread what I wrote yesterday, and it all came back to me so vividly. Not my love for Jamie, but the sweet heat and the flavor of that time. I don't think I feel like writing today. January 16th. After Jamie, Father was vigilant. I was young, too young to marry, but if there had been one Jamie, there might be others. Father really did love me. He wanted me to be safe. Safe for what? For heaven, I guess, or for my own life, although that's hardly likely. Maybe for him, for his love and anxiety's sake. I must try to believe that, because I'm crying less these past few days. Instead, I'm feeling angry. Father brought Meredith home for dinner because he was new in town and probably lonely, or so he said. More than likely for a certainty, in fact, he had checked his credentials. 28 to my 18, staunch member of the Presbyterian Church and a generous contributor to the building fund. Immaculately dressed in navy suits with white shirts, blindingly white with starched collars, well-spoken, courteous, 6 feet 1 inches, undeniably handsome and with a good, dependable job. Gerald came to me today and begged me to argue his case with his father. He is very unhappy. I went to Meredith and told him I thought Samantha was a kind and loving person, and that Gerald was, after all, an adult who should make his own decisions. You cannot imagine how much courage it took for me to do this, or maybe you can, it being your business to understand this kind of thing. Meredith does not rant and rave like Father. This quality is what drew me to him in the first place. I did not then realize that anger has many faces, and that there are a lot of subtler forms of violence and violation. Meredith looked at me very coldly and said, "I cannot imagine how anyone supposedly clever can be so stupid. You claim to love this boy, and yet you are perfectly willing to wreck his life. I forbid you to side with him. Your view of love is naive and permissive. Kindly leave this matter entirely to me." When I tried to interrupt, he broke in and said, "Allison, if you please, I do not wish to discuss this further." I can't really see that writing all these things down is very helpful. It is true that I am crying less, but I am not sure that it is any improvement to be feeling this terrible new anger and frustration. I gathered up some rugs today and hung them outside on the lawn. Then I took a heavy stick and beat them until the yard was a fog of dust. I did not even feel tired when I finished, and then I went inside and slept for 2 hours. Meredith was not pleased when supper was late, but said nothing. He sighed a great deal. However, I wanted to kick him or hang him on the line and beat him with a stick. January 20th. I'm remembering things that I must have shoved away to the back of my mind. I don't understand how your brain can let this happen. Surely significant things, good or bad, should be written in headlines at the forefront of one's brain. But no, apparently not. I have remembered something that happened the summer after my innocent fling with Jamie. I was 17, and I was delivering some of my mother's homemade bread to an old lady who was sick. Mrs. Bellamy was her name. She lived on the other side of town, and I took a shortcut across O'Donohue's field to get there. It was not really a field, but a rough place with two hills, a lot of bushes, and a little creek. On my way across the smaller of the hills, I decided to go down by the creek and to see if there were any Indian pipes. What I found by the edge of the water were not Indian pipes, but my father and Miss Henderson, the director of the junior choir. They were kissing. They didn't see me. Try as I will, I can't remember one single other thing about that morning. Whether or not the bread ever reached old Mrs. Bellamy, I do not know. However, I do recall hearing my mother and father talking in the kitchen that afternoon. She was speaking. Mr. O'Toole said he tried to get you on the church phone this morning, but no one answered. There was a pause. Then my father said, then he must have been calling the wrong number. I never left the office all morning. I now recollect trying to argue myself out of what I had seen and heard, much as one tries to talk oneself into a belief in Santa Claus after seeing one's mother fill the stockings. Maybe that wasn't really my father down there. I brushed aside the evidence, his diamond socks, knitted by my mother, sticking out below his trouser cuffs, his briefcase on the ground beside him with his gold initials on it, gift from the Missionary Society, and I said to myself, it was not him, it was not him. And if it had not been my father, then I had not heard him tell that lie. Then I forgot about it for 28 years. Meredith has told Gerald that if he marries Samantha, he must leave the company. Meredith Wentworth and Sons Limited. Gerald came and asked my opinion and advice. He said he had always hated working for the company anyway, but had done it because of family pressure. Family pressure, my foot, I thought. Let us call a spade, if you please. Father pressure. I knew that Gerald had once wanted to be a garage mechanic. As Jamie had been exactly that, I guess I had not looked on it as such a disgraceful thing to be. But Meredith had refused to consider it for 2 seconds. Pride, the first deadly sin. I told Gerald that I had been forbidden to offer advice or to discuss the matter with him. Please, Mom, he begged, please. I probably know what I'm going to do anyway, but tell me what you think. How do you feel about it? Do you love her a great deal? I asked. Yes, he said. Oh, yes. Then leave, I said. The company will survive, and so will we, and so will you. Then I kissed him. I'm feeling neither angry nor weepy tonight. I am feeling rather pleased with myself. February 1st. What a month this has been. I may become a chronic diarist. I won't pretend that it solves everything. I'm feeling like a cracked egg. Very, very fragile. But ready. Do you know what I mean? When Meredith heard from Gerald that he was leaving the company, he came to me and cried. Cried! If you had asked me, I would have said that all of Meredith's tears had dried up at birth, that there was no room in this man for fury or grief or for passionate responses. So life is full of surprises. I comforted him. I felt like the strong one. And that night I was visited by another memory. When I was 18 years old, several months before I met Meredith, I was struck by a car. I was not hurt, but I was taken to the hospital for routine examination. Insurance regulations required it. Word reached my parents that there had been an accident before they received the news that I had not been injured. When they arrived at the hospital, Father pushed my mother aside and rushed to where I sat on a straight chair in the emergency ward. He took me in his arms and held me so tightly that I remember hurting all over. Thank God you're safe, he gasped. Oh, Allison, I'm so sorry, forgive me. Try to forgive me, oh my child, thank God you are safe. Then he put his head down on my shoulder and cried like a child. Much of that scene is fuzzy in my memory, and I don't know what any of it means or why I forgot it. But whatever else he may have meant, I can see now that two messages were clear. One, he was a human being after all. Two, he loved me very much. In any case, my moment of truth was short-lived because I fainted soon afterwards. When I came to, the scene was locked away where it was very hard to find. February 15th. Samantha and Gerald are to be married on April 2nd. Meredith has told Gerald that he may remain in the company after all, but Gerald has informed him, very nicely, that, thank you very much, he's already been accepted for a course in auto mechanics at the community college. He has some money saved. Besides, Samantha has a job. Meredith took this hard, but he is trying to adjust to all the new things that are happening to him. Luther is not trying to adjust to anything at all, although yesterday I astonished him by telling him he was an insufferable snob. I hope he will think about that. If this makes him angry with me, that's just too bad. Jane can prop him up, and I'm sure she will. Samantha's mother died when she was 10, so I am helping her with her wedding dress. She has a flair for design, and I am good with a needle. The pattern is a bit extreme, but she has the looks and the figure to carry it off. We will keep it our secret until the wedding day. She is warm and communicative. I think she is going to be the daughter I had always longed for. She says she has a lot to learn from me. She doesn't realize how much I need to learn from her. Meredith will be all right. He hasn't really changed. It's just that now I'm ready to see things in him that must have been there all along. If you lie right down on your belly, yes, I said belly, with your face pressed flat into the floor, you can't criticize people if they walk over you. My mother was a doormat all her life, and I can't say I look back on her with any feeling stronger than a tender pity. I know it irritated Meredith when I was going through that weepy phase, and I can't say I blame him. Yesterday he said something arrogant to me, and I said to him, Meredith, you are not God Almighty, and I would appreciate a little humility around here. He was obviously dumbfounded, but it was also clear that he preferred this approach to that of the teary-eyed wimp. He is not my idea of Lochnaver, riding out of the West, and never was, but we'll manage, we'll be fine. I never had any intention of showing you this diary, not really. But maybe I will. I'm even tempted to invite you to the wedding. I feel that you are sort of responsible for it, one way or another. The end.